welcome to this Praxis audio conference offered by Praxis and the Office on Violence Against Women. It's the top of the hour, so we're going to get rolling today with our topic, which is enhancing victim safety through law enforcement. And our trainer today is Melissa Skaya. She is joining us from Grand Rapids, Minnesota, not too far from where I'm calling from today in Duluth. So welcome, Melissa. Hi.
Hi.
So before Melissa gets started, I always go over a couple of just introductory points to let everyone on the line know how these calls work, and then Melissa will just get started with our topic. So I'd like to just remind you all or let you all know that the operator will keep the phone lines muted for the duration of the training today, and when Melissa is ready to take questions and comments in probably 20 or 30 minutes, the operator at that time will give you directions for how to get into the question queue. If you have a question between now and then, if you would just jot it down and save it for that time, that would be most helpful. And we also sent you a PowerPoint for Melissa's presentation today, so if you can, follow along with that. So with that, I would like to welcome Melissa Skaya, my colleague at Praxis.
Sure. As was said, my name is Melissa. I'm currently the director, executive director of a domestic violence agency in rural Minnesota. In our community as the executive director, it's in part my responsibility and our community educator to do these sorts of trainings. I've been doing them for over 10 years now, working with other community agencies and then just public groups about educating them about domestic violence. I've done a number of them with law enforcement agencies locally and then traveling around the country with Praxis to work with law enforcement agencies and prosecutors' offices, probation offices, a lot of criminal justice work around this issue. And so I've developed a lot of these and been thinking about them for quite a long time. I do want to say that, while I am going to be presenting information, because this is an audio conference training, we will stop at a couple points and have a break for some questions. And so I'll just, Liz, I guess I'll just let you know when that is.
Yeah,
okay.
Absolutely.
And then we'll open up the lines, and then people can ask questions. So if you have questions along the way, feel free to jot them down as I'm going along, and then when we open up the lines, you can ask them. But it doesn't have to only be questions. We certainly welcome comments. I'm not the only person, of course, that's thought about this or done this, so feel free to share a comment, a technique, or a strategy, or an organizational way in which you've worked with law enforcement in terms of providing these sorts of trainings. So this topic, Train the Trainer, I just want to make sure that everyone knows who the audience is for this generally. The audience for this call generally should be, or the people who get the most out of it, are people who will either actively participate or organize a training for law enforcement on domestic violence. So you could be a community educator at a domestic violence agency or public awareness coordinator, or you could be a member of law enforcement who helps coordinate it or actually does the law enforcement training. Know that, of course, my background is in advocacy. I'm not a law enforcement officer by any formal training at all, but we will talk about what are the strengths and weaknesses of being in that position and doing this sort of work with law enforcement. And so I just want to make sure that people are on the right call and understand the context for which this is going to be talked about and done. And so we chose to focus on law enforcement because we felt like a lot of domestic violence agencies and law enforcement officers do a lot of mutual training and train each other, but we know in particular that a lot of law enforcement agencies have mandatory trainings on domestic violence, annual trainings, and that it is a fairly, it's a common training that does occur. Although I will say that if you are doing other trainings in your community, you can use some of the principles or the techniques and strategies that I'm going to give you here today, and you can use those for other trainings. So if you would do one with child protection or a local community church, you can use them also there. So I will say generally that I'm going to do this training, of course, with you over the phone because that's the method of communication we've chosen. But I'm going to have to try and be a bit descriptive about some of the physical actions that will take place over this audio format. And so some of that may be challenging. Now, I'm a visual learner anyway myself, and so I particularly always have to have, like, the PowerPoint up in front of me when I'm listening in on these sorts of calls. And so some of this is going to require some visualization in your mind when I describe something that we try, and I hope it's going to be clear for you. We'll do our best. And you can always feel free to email me afterwards. I think my contact information is at the end, and then we could communicate further. So with that, we're going to get started. So the first thing that I want each of you to think about is I want you to think about all of the trainings that you've been to, that you've participated in as a participant. And I want you to think about what makes it a good one and what makes it a not-so-good one. So, for example, I am sure that all of you have had a training where it was not one that you enjoyed, or it was just boring, or it wasn't engaging, or the speaker acted in a way that you just thought wasn't appropriate, that we've all had one of those experiences. And then in the same way, we've all had experiences where the trainers really made a strong impact on us, has influenced our thinking, has helped us better address the way in which we do our work and the way in which we approach our work. So I just think that I say that because I think we have to think as a participant also when we're a trainer. So, for example, even though I provided you this PowerPoint, I'm not I'll just give as an example that a training that I find hard to participate in is where someone reads the PowerPoint to me, and there's very very few examples that are given and how to try things and do things, and that it's that's a really painful training for me to be a part of. So I'm going to try and not do that with you today. And so I'm just really trying to be conscientious about it. Now, some of you may, that may be your style and the way in which you do it, but if you are, I want you to think about it in a way of as a participant, or participant in a different training, if that's how you want to receive the information. So I think it's a good reflection point for all of us to be thinking about. And so it's really important that if you're going to be doing a law enforcement training, that you take the time to prepare for it. So, for example, if you get a call today from your local police chief that says, I need you to come over here and do a training tomorrow morning at 8, and it's your local community and it's 3:30 and you leave in an hour, unless you're planning on spending a lot of your evening preparing for it, or you already have something that you've spent a lot of time on doing, it's probably not the best idea to do. Now, you may not want to pass up the opportunity, and I understand that those things happen. But generally, over time, if you're a person that's going to be doing a lot of trainings, you should work sort of on a shell training that you would give to any law enforcement agency, and then you'd make adaptations depending on the agency. So, for example, just because the police chief says, you know, I'd like you to come and do a training with my officers, you need to know, is it going to be all the officers? Is it going to be the newly hired officers? Is it going to be the officers that are on the road? Is it going to be the investigators? That you have to find out more details about who the audience is going to be in terms of preparing of the training. Now, I think it's important to put what your goals are going to be based in writing, and think about what you want to have happen. So, for example, you want to ask yourself the question, how do I want the officers to leave that room and think differently? Or how is it that I want them to experience this crime scene differently, or this victim differently, or this perpetrator? What is it that I want to have them do differently once they leave this training? And so I think that that's really important. I've observed a lot of trainings with people when I've done some site visits and other things and talked with people, and they kind of do this canned domestic violence 101 presentation that's not tailored to the audience. And I think that that's a mistake in that if people can't relate it to their work, and if we can't bring out examples from people from their work, we've really missed an opportunity. And while we may have some level of effect, I think that we'll have greater level of effect if we can tailor what we're going to say to the specific police officers, maybe their ranking, how long they've been there, or even just all law enforcement, not just a basic domestic violence 101 training, that we really have to think about that and tailoring that sort of training. We have to be thinking about in terms of who should actually be doing the training, because from an advocacy program perspective, you may get the call, or even if you were in law enforcement and kind of known as the domestic violence, let's say you work in law enforcement and you're known as the domestic violence investigator. Well, you may be really good at investigating domestic violence crimes. You have to be honest with yourself about whether you're the best person to do the training, because not everyone that can actually do the work can do the training. So, for example, there are advocates that work at my agency who are amazing advocates who do great work to advocate on behalf of individual women, but I would never ask them to do education training or public awareness event on domestic violence because it's not their strength. And so we have to be really careful about who we're sending doing these, their comfort level with them, and at some level, you know, what their style is like in terms of doing these trainings. And I also think that it's very, very important. So, for example, I'm known as a community advocate, as the director of the agency, that if I get asked to do it, I am not going to be the only person doing the training. I think it's critical that it be done with someone inside the organization, meaning someone who actually works for the law enforcement agency. So within every law enforcement agency, I know that most advocates know who their friends are in the law enforcement agency. Now, at some agencies, it may be everyone, and at other agencies, it may be just like three of the officers and the one investigator. So you have to find the people who you feel like really get it in terms of understanding what's going on in cases of domestic violence, and two, that have the reputation and respect within the organization. That's sort of the ideal person to actually be doing the training with you. I don't think that any advocate under the best circumstances should do these trainings alone, that you really need to partner on them. Now, that's another indication of how it takes a lot of work in terms of preparation, unless you find someone you can do it with a number of years over and over. But you really do need to think about not doing this sort of training alone. You want to think about giving people also real strategic tools in terms of what they're going to be leaving that training with. So when I was talking about the goals, for example, you, in terms of what you want to have happen and what you want the trainees to learn, there is a thing about domestic violence. So, for example, you're not going to be training an officer on interviewing, right? That is something that they're going to be getting at police academy, they're going to be getting in their internal trainings, and from experience. So you're not going to say, okay, here's how to do an interview with someone who's a victim. Because, for example, this is not just any victim that they're going to be interviewing, right? You wouldn't interview a victim of a robbery in the same way that you're going to interview a victim of domestic violence. And so those are the things that you want to be thinking of and always leaving people with, is getting them to think about what is it about this particular crime that's unique and that requires a different approach and way of thinking as opposed to a drug case, as opposed to a robbery case, as opposed to a stranger assault. That there is a different element because of the intimate relationship and the family relationship that these people have together. And so that's one of sort of the key things that we have to get people just to, we have to emphasize when we do these trainings, and we have to think about. So we have to convey this uniqueness of this sort of crime. Because for some officers in some rural communities, for example, they you know, and it varies, but in some communities I've talked to officers where they get a few domestic violence calls a year that, you know, based on when their shift was, that they may just not have happened on their shift, or based on the number of emergency calls that are coming to law enforcement. So it may be a few. So you'd really have to spend the time, for someone who's not getting a lot of calls, talking about the uniqueness. Now, in other communities, the majority of their calls might be domestic violence related, and you wouldn't have to spend as much time talking about that because they're experiencing at some level themselves. Although we do hope that we will convey the idea that it does require this uniqueness in its approach. So that's really, really important. But other examples of ways of thinking about some of the goals you might have is thinking about, you know, how are they going to interpret what they see? So, for example, how are they thinking about property being damaged? Are they thinking about the way that, you know, this is when it's an intimate partner, that maybe just the lamp being turned over is just that's the way, you know, things are kind of messy in the house? Or, maybe I should think or ask about how is it and why is it that that lamp came to be overturned in that house? And so it's a different way of thinking about it because it's interpreting really this relationship that's going on in this family, in this home. So you really want to help people see this crime differently and help officers also think about this. You also have to be really, really clear and knowledgeable before you go into these trainings. So, for example, if you're going to be doing a training with a law enforcement agency, you need to know and have a copy and have read and ask questions about what their policies are and about how they implement them. So the implementation part in many communities is called the protocol or the procedure. The policy is sort of the regulation per se or the law of the organization. But we have to know those for anybody that's going to be trained. Now, of course, if you're doing it with a law enforcement officer in the agency, they're going to know it. But even for them to get a refresher on it. So, for example, if they have a particular policy related to predominant aggressors, related to mandatory arrests, related to battered women who use force, or a particular policy related to dual arrests, you're going to want to know those. You're going to want to know what they are. You're going to want to know the language of those because we have to remember that workers, i.e. meaning the officers, their work is in part guided by the policies of their organization. So you as a trainer are not going to make much headway in terms of creating a change if you're asking them to do something contrary or conflicting with their own agency's policies. So you have to know what those are because the policies of the organization guide the work. They're the directive for the worker in the organization. So in this scenario, the directive for the officer. So for example, if you're asking the officer to do something different with a woman in terms of asking questions to a woman, but their policy says you must ask a victim these five questions, and one is quite a bit different, you're going to have to really work the organization in changing the directive for that law enforcement officer's work. So we're really asking and thinking about in terms of these goals is we want people to be able to, and law enforcement officers, to fully think through what they're seeing and thinking about what's different about this sort of crime and how to interpret it differently. But this issue of policies is really, really important and critical that you really need to know those, have read those, and understood those before you do training, in particular with law enforcement officers. Because they need to have a clear understanding, and that may be, you know, an easy role for someone, of course, that you're doing the your co-training with in terms of someone within the agency. So, for example, let's say if I'm going to co-train with someone inside the organization and I'm going to do it with the supervisor, a part of the training can be that the supervisor provides that clear understanding of the policy's purpose and application. So, for example, I remember a training that I did in Minnesota, and the domestic assault law in Minnesota is very clear about what it means to be a domestic assault, but it's quite different from other states. And what we learned from doing this training is many officers didn't realize that this certain part of the statute even existed. So, for example, in Minnesota, it's a misdemeanor domestic assault if there is fear of harm or actually physical harm or assault. And so it was that first part, the fear of. So a battered woman doesn't even need to have been assaulted. But if they fear that they were going to be, an officer in the state of Minnesota can make an arrest. There's probable cause to arrest. And so that was a statewide law that, of course, the local police department wanted their officers to enforce. And so we spent a fair amount of time about what sort of scenarios and situations that would fall under. So just need to be thinking about what role also you would have the co-trainer be with you. And I think that the policy portion or the statute portion of the training is a really critical one. It's an easy fit for that person to do. You also want to make sure that, in terms of the goals, that they have different insight about the behaviors. So, for example, this sort of a common behavior that many police officers have told me and I've known other advocates have heard is that, geez, you know, when I got to that call, that woman was crazy. She was acting crazy. She was screaming at me. She was running around. And he was sitting back just saying, look at her. Look at her. She's crazy. Don't let her tell you that I'm the problem here. Look at her, right? And so we have to think about those sort of behaviors in a context. And the context is very, very important in terms of understanding the thinking. So thinking about victim behaviors and talking about victim behaviors and perpetrator behaviors and the behaviors of children, gaining new insight in that is really important. We also want to have officers sort of work through their own biases in domestic violence cases. So, for example, a number of common biases of law enforcement include, I recently worked on a criminal domestic violence trial, and the officer was talking to me, and was the officer that made the arrest, and I was testifying as an expert witness in a different community in Minnesota, and so I was just talking to him about the case after it was all done, and he said, you know, most of all victims, they're either all making it up or they're all lying afterwards. Which is it, right? And so he had this bias or this belief that either all victims lie initially or, you know, they're lying afterwards. Which is it? Because he over and over and consistently saw victims changing their stories. It was a common theme in almost every domestic violence case he had. And so you have to have an understanding of what are some of those frustrations. So, and, you know, and that may also be a bias. It's like, well, this is the way I see it. This is what I see all the time, right? So for all of us, that becomes our bias in anything. And so in all of our work, so I may see as an advocate that all men who batter act this way, you know, a certain way, but that may not be true in the same way that an officer may think that all victims are just going to change their stories. So we have to be realistic about those biases and those frustrations that law enforcement officers have. We have to know what they are in our own community, and we have to be willing to address them, and we have to be able to work through them. Those are really, really important. Otherwise, when they leave the training, their biases, their frustrations, their beliefs will not have been challenged or changed in any way. And so we have to work to really address those when we're doing these sorts of trainings. So it's been a half hour, Liz. I think I'm going to stop right there, if that's okay.
Yeah, sure. Stephanie, would you be willing to give us all direction for asking questions or making a comment?
At this time, if you do have a question or a comment, please press the number 1 on your touch-tone phone at this time. Be sure to press the digit 1 only once. If you press it more than once, you will remove yourself from the question queue. And so far, we have no questions in the queue.
So we're not also just looking for questions. We're also just looking for thoughts or comments or an experience that someone else has done a training. Has anyone done a co-training with anyone and found that to be helpful or address policies? Any comments also we welcome.
And once again, at this time, we have no callers in the queue.
Okay, Liz, I think I'm just going to keep going, if that's okay.
Yeah, sure. I have a quick question for you.
Sure.
So, you know, much of this presentation really is predicated on the notion that it's the trainings are going to be done in partnership, as you said, the DV agency with someone from the law enforcement, you know, as a co-trainer. And so do you have any tips for programs about how to begin those connections if they don't have them already, any kind of, you know, natural crossover or a, you know, connection with their local law enforcement? Do you have any suggestions of how to begin fostering that relationship to, you know, be able to do really solid law enforcement training?
Well, I think it's really important, for example, you know, law enforcement agencies in particular, and I mean, all agencies have some level of this in my experience, but law enforcement agencies in particular have a particular hierarchy about them in terms of who has what responsibility and who is in charge of what, and there's a very sort of strong chain of command and protocol within the culture of law enforcement agencies. Now, that's my outside perspective. I could be completely wrong, but I do want to say generally that's my experience. So in order to really partner with someone, I think it's important to find someone who has some sort of supervisory connection. So, for example, in our community, our supervisors, so we have three supervisors at our Sheriff's Department, and they all supervise deputies from different regions of the county. And so every once in a while, we'll just spend time with that supervisor at one of the regular staffings or beforehand and develop relationships that way. So more of a small group setting. Now, I know some communities are really small and they have like one officer or two officers. So, but in some ways, I do think it's important that you do have someone who has some level of authority within the organization, I think is important, and build a relationship with that person.
Yeah. We do have a detective on the line. I wonder if I could pick on Detective Jones. She's calling in from Florida today. If you are still on the line, Detective Jones, would you be willing to press 1 on your keypad and share any experiences that you might have with your local DV organization? Are you with us?
Okay, Detective, your line is open.
Okay, first, our agency just implemented my position, so I'm fairly new in the Detective Domestic Violence Unit. So speaking from my position, I really haven't experienced any, I guess, scenarios that I can share with you guys. But one thing is that actually I work in a rural area, and when you were speaking on the biases that I've come across, that a lot of the deputies out here, you know, when you touched on the fact that, you know, they go out to the calls and it's either they feel like they're frustrated because either the victim, like 2 or 3 days later, is back in a relationship. They, you know, we go to a court with the state attorneys. The victims are not cooperating. You know, they're kind of basically changing their story, and they're not getting a lot of convictions or cooperation with the victims. So that's really what's going to be the challenge over in my area.
Right. So that was kind of what I was alluding to when I was giving the example, because it's the most common one that I've heard across the country about officers' frustration. So, for example, then if you're going to design a training with law enforcement officers, you have to talk about that issue, and you have to talk about it in depth, right? So that issue in and of itself has multiple parts to it. And so you could spend literally a half a day, right, just taking apart that scenario, right? So the officer goes out, he has this experience. 3 days later, he gets called back and the woman's back there, or he finds out she's back there, right? So then you can just take that, say, okay, now what do we think that that's about? First of all, we have to think about why is it that battered women call for the assistance of law enforcement officers, right? We have to start there. because they've been called to the home, and we have to think about what's the motivation and the reasons that battered women do that. So one of the ways, if you talk to enough battered women, you will hear from a number of battered women, not all, but a number of battered women, that they called the police because they were scared. They were in fear, or if they didn't call, somebody else called because they were in fear for them. And so this is a very, very different way of thinking about relationships. So, for example, many battered women, in fact, I'm working with a battered woman right now who recently called the police, and she said it clearly, and I know many other advocacy agencies talk about this, but she just said, she goes, Melissa, I dialed 911 because I was scared, not because I want to end my marriage with them, but because I was scared, and I want the violence in my house to end, but I don't necessarily want my relationship to end. I still have some hope for it. So that's one battered woman's experience, but it's also a fairly common one that law enforcement officers see. They see it all the time. And so we can't avoid it. We have to talk about it, but we have to talk about it in a way that just elevates the realities that battered women face. Does that kind of fit with what you're experiencing or you're seeing?
Yes.
Yeah.
And see, also we have a victims advocate that works with me as well, and I guess we're kind of challenged at the fact that, you know, just like you said, a lot of victims call because they're in fear, but then once she touched bases with them, it's like, okay, they don't want the suspect to go to jail. Like you said, they just want the help. But then they really don't want to go through, you know, take advantage of the services that are offered.
Right, and I think a way to think about it is that, you know, many battered women don't want interveners in their life because they're a bit skeptical about whether they're really going to be helpful. That they may have had an experience with someone that wasn't helpful, or they're in such fear of the ramifications of them on whether someone gets involved with him, because the reality is that for many battered women, that the more the police talk to him, the more pressure and violence that happens to her. Because there is this very strong notion in domestic and battering that has a privacy notion about it, which is that we must keep private and in our home, all, you know, and of course that comes with that, is all the private, keep private all the abuse and violence that occurs. And so many battered women really want to try and figure it out themselves. Now, I am also going to say that many bad women are also, you know, minimizing what's happening in their home. There are a number of women who are doing that, who with some really sort of strong encouragement and sort of can, you know, are in our, when they're out of it, see it differently. But there is this element of that bad women are so isolated for so long that that's all they know as their life. And so we just have to think about, I think a critical thing, too, is about when we approach and talk to bad women and how much time we spend with them. So one of the things that has to come with this sort of training between law enforcement advocacy agencies is how are we as advocates and law enforcement officers really coordinating our work in a very strong way that meets the needs of women and creates an intervention that's safe and holds offenders accountable. So one example of doing that is that the moment that she calls 911 and a law enforcement officer is called, and then the scene is secure, or someone's been arrested, or whatever they decide needs to happen, that is an absolutely critical time for us to spend with battered women. And so we have to figure out and coordinate that. So, for example, in our community, we have a police phone. So we don't use we have a separate phone for, which else can be known as a hotline in other communities, but law enforcement calls us and we go there. We go there and spend in-person time, one-on-one time with women. And so it can be very labor-intensive, but I will tell you that there becomes this level of disconnect at some level when our contact is a day after the incident, when it's 48 hours after the incident, and when it's only on the telephone. But it takes an extraordinary amount of resources, so we have to think about that.
Okay, just think. So, do you guys, is it different levels that you decide whether you're actually going to go out on the scene? Like, is it, you know, if it's something serious or is it minor, or you just go out on all?
All of them.
Okay.
Yep, all of them. Yeah.
Okay, because we have our agency split into two. We have level one and level two calls. So our level two, the deputies will actually call an advocate on the scene and let the victim speak to them. But a level one call, someone will actually come out on the scene and speak with them.
Mm-hmm.
That's why.
I think that the problem that comes from that is that the initial information that a better one would give, or the charge that would be given, doesn't necessarily give the extent and context of the violence. Because my experience is that once you spend about 20 to 30 minutes with a battered woman, you get a much better sense about the severity and frequency of the violence. But, and for many battered women, they're just not going to tell a law enforcement officer that, because, for one, it's not a confidential communication. And so it's not really until battered women are assured that they have a confidential relationship with someone that they're really going to tell some of the depths of the abuse that's happening in their home. So I think, Liz, maybe we should just keep continuing unless there's any other questions or comments.
Yeah, let's do that. And thanks very much, Detective Jones, for letting me pick on you. And
let us call
your contributions. If you have other questions or comments that you would like to follow up with Melissa after the call, her contact information is on the PowerPoint. So we'll have another time for question and comment in a few minutes, and you certainly can make more contributions at that point or connect with her after the session. So, Melissa, if we can take some more of your slides, and then we'll take another break again for question and comment.
Okay, great.
Thanks.
So this is a really important part of the training, which is to think about what is it that we want to be included in a domestic violence training. So there are some two really key things that you want to have present, and one of which is the realities that battered women face. So as I was just speaking with the officer from Florida, was that so if we know that this is the experience of law enforcement officers, we have to bring the realities that battered women face into the room. And so when I talk about the realities, I'm saying that we have to bring in their stories, we have to bring in their experiences, and we have to just bring it in a way that's effective. So you can do this a number of ways. You can do it through the use of a video. So, for example, I think that one of the best ones available is from Praxis called The Story of Rachel. And the reason why I like The Story of Rachel is that it's not a very long video and it has great audio, but it brings forth the complexities that battered women face of what's going on in their life. Because I think the misconception sometimes is that when a criminal case is going on in a battered woman's life, that that's the central focus of her life. And for so many battered women, it's not. And many battered women simply want it to go away. And so for other battered women, they want to be up there at the courthouse or at every hearing. They want to give input. And so there's this whole wide range of experience. But we have to think about how we're going to bring battered women into the room. So that's one way to do it. Another way to do it is to have a battered woman in your community or a neighboring community that's had an experience where she called for help, and for her to talk about the reasons why she did what she did, what her thinking was, what her motivation was, what was important to her. All of those things are really critical and important in terms of bringing that reality into the room. Another way to do it, and I think this has been a really effective way, and I'm going to talk about this a little bit more later in terms of the probable cause video, but there are many, many mainstream popular media videos that have a depiction of a domestic violence incident. And so, for example, you can bring in that DVD or movie. So, I mean, there's lots of them. The movie North Country, the movie What's Love Got to Do with It, the movie Personal Velocity. There's a whole bunch of popular video movies that have incidents of domestic violence that you then can get law enforcement officers to think through. And I think it's particularly effective, and I've found this to be always very fascinating, is depending on which video pick, if you do use this technique, is that you will first put the what they're about to see on paper. So just summarize it, almost like how a police report would be written, and not maybe not all of you have seen them written, but it's just a very, you know, it applies to the law. It's a factual analysis of the scenario. It says who did what to whom, what crimes were committed. Is to do that, or just to talk about the scenario, and then to show the video. Because we have to remember that the text or the paper often stands into real people's lives. So whenever possible, we want to try and bring also in some visual representation or real-life human representation that battered women face. So that's really important. Now, for the advocates on the call here, I do want to say that this is really important. I know I have done this myself, so I did this at a point in my advocacy life where there were some times where I've been known to moralize battered women in general. So this is a mistake. Don't stand up in front of law enforcement officers and say that every battered woman is the best mother, every battered woman, you know, never uses violence. Because, I mean, these are just notions that just aren't true. Now, I'm not saying that you would say it as directly as I just said it, but I will tell you that the trainees, meaning the officers who you are training, will pick up your vibe, your attitude about whether you're moralizing battered women. It's a huge mistake to do that. Because, listen, not every battered woman I have met do I want to go have coffee with and be the sort of person that would I'd want to be my friend. It's just I'm not going to connect with every battered woman, you know, and I'm not saying that I do, you know, have these intimate personal relationships, but just in terms of how we connect, I'm very interested in helping people find the safety they need. But we're all going to have different experiences with battered women, and we make it a mistake to not to moralize battered women sort of in general. So we have to be thinking about that. So we have to be thinking about battered women's reality. So I do want to tell a story of a woman that I've shared before, and I always encourage people to, when if you're the person that does training your communities, that if I tell a story, you can take that story and you can replicate it and act as if you're on it. I'll tell you that I've been doing trainings for so long that sometimes I don't remember if the story is really mine or it's one I've heard from someone else, like from one of my mentors. But anyway, I think that stories are really important. So I'll just tell you a story of an example of a woman. So this woman's name, we'll say, is Bonnie Weber. And Bonnie had been experiencing a lot of battering in her home for many, many years. So Bonnie, at this point in her life, is 62. Her children are grown. They're moved out of the home. Her husband, Henry, his violence has been increasing. She calls her agency, and she arranges it so that, because Bonnie has no access to resources, she lives way out in the middle of nowhere in the woods, literally, and she needs a ride. And she doesn't feel comfortable calling any of her friends or her family, but she wants to get out of the house and she needs a ride, and we need to get her before her husband gets home from work. And so I tell her that it's her agency policy, that I can't just go get her unless I have someone with law enforcement with me, because in case he would come home, it might, you know, blah, blah, blah. So anyway, what ends up happening is Bonnie's okay with that. The law enforcement officer and I go out to the house, and we're sort of, we know that Bonnie sees us. We see her look through the window. We say, you know, we're thinking, okay, Bonnie, hurry up. We're worried that he's going to come home early from work, because we have an indication that he may know that she's making some preparations to leave. So we end up going to the house, knocking on the door, and Bonnie comes to the door and says, I'll be done in 5 minutes. I just need to finish mopping this kitchen floor, and that's the floor that we're standing right by. And we say to her, no, Bonnie, you don't need to worry about mopping the floor. It's really okay. You know, the house does not have to be clean. And so she says, no, I have to do it. Please let me do it, and I'll explain later. So we get back in the car about, ends up to be more like 10 minutes. Bonnie comes back in the car, and we say, you know, why did you think that you needed to mop the floor? And she said, because in my house, she says, my husband, Henry, he sees it as my responsibility to keep the house clean. And he particularly really likes the kitchen floor to be clean. So if the kitchen floor is freshly mopped and still wet when he comes home, he won't go into the house and he'll go out to the garage. And so he won't have noticed, one, that I'm not there, and two, that I've packed a lot of things, and it'll give me more time to escape. So here is an experience of a batter woman who's really strategizing, and this sort of action has a lot of meaning for. And so I tell that story because I think it brings out her reality of what she's experiencing, of what needs to take place in order for her to be able to get away longer and farther. And so it's that sort of story, I think, that, you know, and I'm sure that you all have other stories in your communities, but I tell it because I think it'll give you sort of the motivation and the elements to think about in terms of how she's strategizing, what her fear is, what she knows about him, about what she needs to have happen. And so those are the sorts of things that we have to bring in the room. We can't just be in these trainings talking heads and not talking about the realities that better women face. The other really key element that we have to talk about in these sorts of trainings is power. And we have to be talking about relationships of dominance, meaning that we have to talk about that one person, in most cases, of course, we know it's men, who are dominating and battering women and establishing a relationship of fear based on that that power. And so we have to talk about how they use power. We have to talk about how victims feel being in a less powerful position because of the fear that they live in, how vulnerable they feel, how what it's like for them to be in that sort of scenario. And so we also have to be talking about battered women's use of force, because many officers are going to be experiencing battered women who have used violence. And so the problem is that, you know, some of the studies that have come out say, oh, women are hitting men just as much, you know, as men are. First of all, we know that that's not true. Second of all, what we know about women's use of violence is that when women do use violence, it's with, most of the time, it's within a context of reacting to the battering they're experiencing or in defending themselves. And so we have to talk about that. We have to talk about how many of us would act the same. Because what we have, the way in which we talk about battered women, we have to not talk about them how they're different than how any of the rest of us would behave in a similar situation. And so a technique or a training exercise, so now I'm going to try and do something a bit visual with all of you through this audio call, so I hope you're going to understand this sort of quick exercise. But if all of you, if I was standing in front of all of you in a room, and you're all sitting in chairs, and we were in a room in which maybe the ceiling was a tile ceiling, I would say, okay, I want all of you to imagine that the room that you're sitting in right now, but that all of you are in a relationship in which I have all of the money, I have all of the power, and I've used violence against you in the past, and that all of you have no resources at your hands. And so at any time, I have this clicker box up here where I'm standing in the front of the room, and all of your seats correlate with one number here on this clicker box. So, for example, if I press the number 5, the person who's sitting in seat 5, if I press that button, then a sandbag will fall from those tiles above your head and drop on your head, and it will either seriously injure you or it will kill you. And so I want all of you to think about how you would act towards me in that scenario or situation. So, for example, one of the things to ask the officers is, how many of you would be really, really nice to me? And some of them will raise their hand. How many of you would maybe be nice to me for a little while but get tired of that and then not be nice to me? And how many of you would just not care, would not be nice to me, and try and fight back and try and take this clicker away from me? There'll be a number of people who will raise their hands to that. And so that's where you have to go with it. You say, okay, for those of you who say, either early on or at some period of time, you will be resistive to my use of domination of you, let's talk about that. Because that's the reality that many better women experience. So we have to be not thinking about and assuming that battered women's use of violence is sort of this mutual combatant violence, because we just know from talking to too many battered women about that experience. So those are the ways in which we have to be talking about power, about the imbalance of power, and we have to provide strategies and ways of thinking for officers to think differently about the use and the frequency and the severity and the tactics. Because the other things we know about battered women's use of force and men's use of violence is that men often, their violence results in injuries. Now, many battered women's use of violence has resulted in injury, but the way in which they intend to do it and the message and the motivation and the impact in the end is often very, very different. So, for example, my husband happens to be much larger than I am. He's about, 75 pounds more than I am. And so I am not physically capable of strangling my husband. I am just not. But my husband is physically capable of strangling me. So if I want to use violence against him, I'm going to have to use another tactic. And I may probably going to have to do a bit of a hit and run. Because many battered women talk about this. They say, you know what, if I really wanted to hurt him, I better be able to run fast afterwards. Because if he catches me, I'm going to have a lot of problems. So this is the thing in terms of thinking about battered women's experiences that we have to be talking about. And so when we're explaining these experiences, we have to talk about how this is a normal response, that if any of us lived under these conditions, we would act in a same or similar way to try and resist the violence and the domination and the controlling behaviors of men who batter. So we have to think about that in terms of when we're doing these trainings. I've already talked a little bit about deciding the training purpose and focus a little bit, so I just want to just take the probable cause example or probable cause is an example of one element of policing that could be used to be talked about. I think it's really important when you do a law enforcement officer training that you do have some sort of general overview scenario or talking about violence and how is it intersects with law enforcement agencies. But at some point, I do think it's helpful to take one point or one example of policing. So, for example, the determination of probable cause is one act of policing that police officers do. And so this is where we have to, as the trainers, know it ahead of time. We need to define probable cause. We need to know what the working definitions are of those. And then what we want to do is that once the group sort of comes to the definition of the probable cause, then we want to apply it to a case or a scenario. Now, the Domestic Abuse Intervention Project in Duluth has a law enforcement training module that has a number of videos in it, and there is one in particular that's used for probable cause. But you can use, for example, all those public media or popular media videos. You could take those and use those as examples to have as a video. But I think it's particularly important to use some sort of video or case scenario or story when it comes to this. And so, for example, one of the videos that's in the Domestic Abuse Intervention Project Duluth training videos, there's a particular video where it shows a man who has used violence, the woman uses violence back, he ends up having a mark on his face. She says he strangled her, or she says he strangled her, she has marks on her neck, and the police come. But there's a lot more to it that I can't explain over the phone, but you sort of have the idea. But the fascinating thing, I think, about this video, and just a number of other videos you can use, is that what you want to do then is you really want to have sort of make a list on a flip chart and really sort of divide it in half. So you want to say, okay, how many of you would have arrested the man? And have people raise their hand and say, okay, how many of you would have arrested the woman? How many of you would have arrested both? And you have people raise their hand. And then what you're going to pull from that then, because you just not want the answers, you want some of the thinking behind it. You want to pull their thinking. So, okay, for those of you that said you would, tell me why you would only arrest the man. And you want to pull some of that thinking out, and you want to write it down on a flip chart. And for those that said that they would only arrest the woman, you want to pull that out. And so, and those who would do dual arrest, you want to help them think through that. So you always want to work for, like, operative words that people are using, so some real key words. And this idea of having people vote often provides a good dynamic for a group setting. You also then want to get them to think a little bit deeper. So you want to ask them questions about why they think she assaulted him if they didn't see it, or why they think he assaulted her. And then you want to pull up, so an operative word to be predominant aggressor. So somebody says, well, I think he's a predominant aggressor. Okay, that's an operative word or term. So then you need to say to the officer that raised his hand, for example, tell me why you think that. What makes you come to that conclusion, okay? And so you need to spend some time talking with people in that way. And then you want to take those, really, the definition of probable cause, you want to apply it to that scenario, and then you really want to challenge officers. Now, this is a key point in terms of my co-trainer, the officer. This isn't necessarily something that I'm going to do as the trainer. I may participate in it, but I'm probably not going to take the lead on it because of my lack of experience, because of not being in the cultural context of being an officer. I set some ideas about it, but I'm not necessarily going to want to be the lead person for that. But I just think it's really important for us to have dilemmas for officers to have on the table, and you have to have those in the training. You have to hear some of that come out. You can do some of that in small group. You can do some of that in large group. So I think I'm going to stop there because it's 3:00, and see if there's any other more comments, questions, thoughts that people have.
Once again, at this time, if you do have a question or a comment or a thought that you'd like to share in the call today, please press the number 1 on your phone at this time. And at this time, there are no guests in the queue.
I wonder if I can just take a moment. And, Melissa, you had mentioned some resources, and so before I forget, I want to just let you all know how to come across the products, the materials that Melissa was mentioning. So Melissa mentioned the modules that are available on the Domestic Abuse Intervention Program website. And so if you're interested in that, it is an excellent resource and pertains specifically to what it is that Melissa is talking about today. So if you go to www.duluth.org, you will be able to find the domestic violence manual. It's just called Domestic Violence, the Law Enforcement Response, and you can purchase it and order it, use it for your program. Also, The Story of Rachel is available on the Praxis website, www.praxisinternational.org. Under products, it's the very first resource on that products page. And also, Melissa hasn't mentioned it yet, but in the Praxis Library, you will also find under law enforcement, it's under criminal justice system, under the library category on the Praxis website. At the bottom of that page, you'll see the St. Louis County Sheriff's Manual, and that also might be a useful resource, just with some kind of general guidelines. So if you have any questions about those resources and you weren't able to jot them down just now, don't hesitate to call me or email me if you want a little further explanation about them.
Right, and I'm glad that you brought up the handbook, the St. Louis County handbook. So St. Louis County is one of the largest counties actually in the country, but in the state in terms of geographic size, not in terms of population, but That handbook is available in PDF form, so you can literally just print it off. And I think it's a good way just to bring other examples of other communities' policies and protocols to bring to your own community, just to say, okay, here's another community's way of thinking about this. You know, where do we think ours has its strength? Where do we think we need to improve ours? So it's really good for that. So we should be, you could utilize that for that purpose.
Yeah, right. Melissa, just to do a little time check, we have just a bit less than a half an hour and a number of slides to cover. I'd also like to be able to leave a few minutes at the end in case there are questions or comments at that time.
Mm-hmm.
So just a little heads up.
Yep. Okay. Yeah, and there's a remember, I don't really always follow all the slides, but there's a number of slides on here related to resistance, and that's the next topic I'm going to talk about in general and just give some examples, but I'm not going to read all these slides to everyone in terms of resistance. So you want me to step up like 20 after this?
Yeah, that'd be great.
Okay, great. So next we'll just talk a little bit about dealing with resistance in doing a training. Now, this is something that for those of you that have been doing trainings for a while, you have, if you've been doing them, you've experienced it, I'm sure of it. And it may not just be with law enforcement officers. Of course, it's through many groups. It could be with your local church group. It could be with child protection. It could be with the local child abuse council, whichever group it is that you're doing some training and work with, or your judges, whoever it might be. Just the way in which I'm going to talk about resistance can really be applied to any of those ways or any of those audiences. So I do think that we need to expect some resistance on some level when we do these trainings. We can't be romanticizing the idea that our audience is just going to hang on and grasp and just love every word we say, because they're just not. We're most of the domestic violence communities that I know are really presenting some new ideas, for some people, some controversial ideas, and some real notions. So, for example, I was doing a training with our county commissioner, so all of our elected county people, and the topic of spanking ended up coming up, and so I believe in a very nonviolent approach to parenting, and for me, and so I'm just going to share this. This isn't for us to debate. Some of you on this call will not agree with me, but this ended up coming up, and people had resistance. So I was saying, you know, that I don't spank. These are the reasons why I don't. And so it ended up me being more conversational because it wasn't part of my presentation. And so I was thinking back to that when I was thinking about resistance. So this idea by two of the county commissioners was just, they couldn't even believe I said it, because the notion of spanking was something that they do, they actively do, their parents did, and so they wanted to debate with me about it. And I think the hard thing for them is that I wasn't interested in debating. I was interested in presenting my thinking about it, and I was interested in hearing from them about their thinking about it, and I wasn't going to leave the meeting feeling like I didn't make an I didn't accomplish what I need to accomplish if they didn't agree with me. And that's where I think that we have to, as trainers and people doing this sort of work, be to not personalize it that in that way. I've been surprised. I've had people come out and say that I remember one woman said one time when I did training, I'll never forget when you said this. And I didn't even remember saying it. In fact, I didn't even think it was even that special or intelligent. But for her, it just had this, the way in which I said it. And so that's the thing, is we don't really know. And I also believe in the Maya Angelou quote that, you know, people always leave with for sure and how you make them feel. And so that's why I think that resistance is really, really important to talk about with trainers, because we have to be really honest with ourselves about, are they resisting just me? So, for example, that's why I will not do a law enforcement training by myself, because why should they listen to me about it, to talk about their work? Now, I have lots of things to say about domestic violence, but when it comes to to talking about it with applying it to their work. And that's where I really want to make the difference. I can't be the only one to do it. Because I do need to take it personally. They are going to judge me about it, about whether I'm credible or not. I have to ask, why should they listen to me about it? Why should I be the person that they're going to take this message from? So we have to think about that. We have to think about, you know, what is it in our message or the information that we're giving out. But I think it's really important to be really open and to connect with trainees and give real-life examples, and telling stories is a real easy way to do that. But we do, you know, I know that you know what resistance looks like, but it is, you know, for example, if somebody's falling asleep during your presentation, now, they may just be tired. I've been tired and fallen asleep at a training. But it also may be because we're extraordinarily boring. So we do have to be realistic about the fact and reflective about that, or if people are just walking up and leaving. So one of the ways to think about it, now if I was doing this in person, you know, we would do this sort of scenario where we've talked about, if this was more of a format we could have open dialogue, and ask you if any of you have had any resistance to anything I've said, and talk about ways in which I've handled that or not. And so it is a way, even just with your staff at your organization, is just to present some ideas and to think about in any setting. So, for example, you might be at your family gathering over the 4th of July, and you're talking about, let's say, maybe politics, and you end up talking about something, you get some real resistance from someone in your family about your ideas. You have to think about how you handled it, because this is really something that we build as a skill within ourselves to help ourselves overcome it. Because it's not helpful to do what some people call butt heads with people, and we have to be confident in our thinking, but we have to know what we're talking about, and we have to treat our audience and the other people we're engaging in dialogue with respect. And so, you know, I've seen some trainers who've been real patronizing or try to have trick questions. I remember one time going to a training, and a trainer asked a really complex question and then went around the audience and said, and would point out people and say, tell me the answer. And people wouldn't know. And then he would just sort of snub them and walk away. And it just really created this atmosphere that, and this feeling of, oh, you're stupid, you don't know the answer. Now, I don't think he intended to do that, but that's how people left feeling from it. And so then people weren't open to the rest of the ways in which he was talking. I think it's always important to not to totally reject someone. I think it's important to reject ideas, and but to not really you don't want to shut people down. So, for example, there's a whole idea that many men who batter have, that is that in order for to get my kids to respect me, they must be scared of me. And so there was an element of that when I was doing this training with these county commissioners, that they, in essence, were telling me, and one said, you know, if my kid isn't scared of me, I bet then they're not going to ever respect me. And so I did this technique called accept-reject, which is the idea that, say, okay, I can accept the idea that you want your children to respect you, but I can accept, and I can't find a connection by how fear is going to get them to do that. And so this is a technique that's taught by a man called Paulo Freire, and this technique is used in a lot of groups for men who batter, but I think it's useful in a way, which is that you're not totally shutting people down. You're saying, okay, I can accept part of what you're saying, but I am going to reject this part of it. And I wouldn't necessarily use the word reject in the training, but just sort of that whole idea I think is really important, because you don't want to end up in a debate with people. You want to listen to their experiences, but you don't want to bring up defensive tactics. Now, I know when I've been triggered to be defensive, it's happened to me, then I regret it after I've done it. It's happened to me in a training, but it's really, really important to try to not get hooked and to compete with people in terms of the ideas about who's better. Because there is a power element and a power dynamic in the room by the very nature that someone selected you or asked you to be the trainer. You do have a platform that is a bit more powerful position. And so you have to respect that you've been given that, and you can't use that to dominate other people's ideas. I think that we should challenge people's ideas, but we should also not put people in that position. So, and I also think that's important that we sort of talk about that this work is not rigid in the sense that there are many gray areas and ways of thinking that are out there, but we're still trying to figure out many aspects of this work about how it is the most effective way to intervene in families where the man has battered the woman and his children. So we can't be, as trainers, being know-it-alls about this sort of thing. We have to have a bit of humbleness about us when we're doing this work. So I just want to just talk about this example, that an exercise, and then I'll just sort of wrap up here. But so I'm going to need to have you try and be visual about how this would work for a moment. So if I'm doing a training with law enforcement and with advocates, at some time and in some way, I think with the right audience, it is effective just to get out some of the stereotypes, per se, that people have. So I would pick a law enforcement officer in the room, and this would be in particular now if I was doing a joint training between law enforcement officers and advocates. But it could also be effective with just law enforcement officers. So let's say I had both. So I'd say, okay, I need one law enforcement officer to come up here and stand up here. Okay, now I need another advocate, or I also need an advocate. So I want the law enforcement and the advocate to be facing each other, standing up in front of the room. And so then I'm going to stand behind the advocate, and then I'm going to have my co-trainer, who's the law enforcement officer, stand behind the law enforcement officer. So now what we're going to do is we're going to ask the advocate who's volunteered and the police officer who's volunteered just to talk through, you know, an incident of violence that occurred just in the way that they would normally. So we'd make up some scenario. So, for example, the advocate would say, you know, I'm just calling you about so-and-so's case. She's said that last night that she reported a violation of her protective order. So can you tell me what you know about that? So I'd have the advocate say that. And then I would stand behind the advocate and say something. And I would do it, and this is for to bring out some humor and to clear the air. I would say something in effect like, well, I'm calling you because your officers don't ever arrest, they don't take domestic violence seriously, and they don't enforce orders for protection. So, now you may not all think that this is really helpful, but I'll tell you that when you can do it, it just clears the air, right, about some of the thinking that we think is really going on. So then the officer says, well, you know, let me check into it, I'll find out about it. And then the law enforcement co-trainer stands behind him and says, well, that's because all advocates think that all men should be arrested for everything, and if we arrested every man, our jails would be full. And so they do something, some sort of snide but fun, humorous remark that they would make. And I will tell you that it may sound like silly or you wouldn't want to do it, and maybe you won't. I'm just, as in, it has been really effective for us when we know that there's been some ongoing tension. So other communities have tried this when there's been ongoing tension, that they really just sort of clear the air. Because what the trainers end up, in effect, be doing is doing what's called like the self-talk in their head about what they're really thinking about what's going on. And so it just ends up being sort of this fun way to get through some of the resistance that you may experience right at the beginning, just to help go through that. So I just wanted to give that as an example. You'll see that there's a slide here at the end about all the different training methods. These are all different ones that you can try. Role plays are really fun. Handouts, we've talked about, you know, using some visuals. Debate is a fun one to do in the sense that you can get present a scenario or a video, separate people on different sides of the room, and have them debate one thought and idea about how we should approach it, and split up the other group, say, okay, now I want you to defend this way of we should arrest or should not arrest. That has been a way in which to engage people in this work. So I think it's pretty close to 3:20, so I think I'm going to stop there, Liz, if that's all right?
Sure. Sure. So this gives us the last almost 15 minutes, 13 minutes or so, for questions and comments and wrap up. So for all of you who have been kind of quiet so far, reserving your question and comments, we'd love to hear what's on your mind. Again, press 1 on the keypad now if you would like to share your thoughts from the presentation today. And that will get you into the question queue, and the operator will open your line up.
We do have a question from Monroe, Louisiana. Your line is open.
Go ahead, Louisiana.
I do appreciate the information gained today. Great feedback and tips about how to do trainings for law enforcement. We're getting ready to put some things together for our local law enforcement here in rural areas. Do appreciate the feedback from the rural officer as well. And the things that you mentioned were very eye-opening and good heads up for me, and we'll be trying some of these techniques, and I will visit the website. So thank you so much.
Oh, you're welcome. Do you have any questions, or have you done them before? Or
no, I have been in training for about 20 years, but specifically with law enforcement. So,
okay.
Again, just the heads up on things to be mindful of and activities that you might do with them and, you know, I enjoyed that and appreciate it.
Great.
As you begin to strategize for your law enforcement training, you know, down the road, if you run across questions or difficulties, don't hesitate to get back in touch with us. That's exactly what we're here for. And I'll be happy to put you back in touch with Melissa or even perhaps consider some customized training with your organization if that would be helpful. So.
Oh, wonderful.
Hesitate. Yeah. Don't hesitate to utilize us if there's any questions that you have down the road.
Okay. And one other thing I did like in particular, letting law enforcement talk about their frustrations. It helps, I think I'm going to use that part in advance of a training to get that in the open. And that way, when we do design the training program, we'll take into account all of those issues that they have to deal with and try to address those in some way that they might be able to handle it a lot better or move past that.
Great. And one of the ways you can do that ahead of time, kind of like how you're saying, is you can write up like a quick three-question survey to officers that's anonymous.
Mm-hmm.
If your local departments would allow you to do that, so that you would have that, and then you could get that feedback, what's your number one frustration with domestic violence calls?
Okay.
It would just be a simple question. I mean, it could be even just that one, so that, what are things that you think your department should be thinking about, or, any question like that would give you sort of a heads up ahead of time to better prepare yourself.
Excellent. Okay, I appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks.
Our next question does come from Tillamook, Oregon. Your line is open.
Hello.
Hi
there.
Hi. Thank you very much. In the interest of time, my question is on your slide four techniques for overcoming resistance.
Yes.
Can you give an example of the star of the plant that makes an IST comment that you found effective?
Yep. So star of the plant is just this concept and idea that I've done trainings, and this isn't just law enforcement by any means, but
right.
Where there has been the IST comment is sexist, racist, classist, homophobic remark.
Right,
and so
I experience those a lot in our training, so I would appreciate another help.
Yep, and so the star of the plant idea is that you really don't want to water it, sort of metaphorically,
mm-hmm.
which is that I just think that it's really important that in some way you say, you know what, I'd like maybe to talk to you about that afterwards, or, I'm hearing some of what you're saying, but this. So that's the accept and reject idea,
mm-hmm.
which is So I'm just going to throw one, okay, that I've heard. So this is not something I think. Don't repeat this in any way. But, it's something like, you know, well, you know, if all those women would just start, you know, dressing a little nicer, maybe their men wouldn't want to hit them, right? I mean, this is just like, I'm just made this up, but it's a totally sexist remark, okay? And so I would say, okay, I can accept the idea that women don't want to be hit. I agree with you about that. But I can accept the idea that women need to dress better because of it, right? So I've just done like an accept and reject. And so, but I, with some of that sort of is blatant and out there is that sort of comment. And, you know, and there's a lot of racist comments that happen in trainings. We happen to live in a community where a third of our community is a Native American reservation. So I've done a law enforcement training before where someone's made a very racist comment about Native Americans. And so part of it is sort of the age-old idea of right, pick your battles, but it's also about not spending time on it. Because in some ways, I'll tell you that when those things have come up, I've wanted to spend, like, hours on it. Like, deep within me, I've just wanted to spend hours on it. I wanted to tell them how stupid they were. You know, like, I'd never do that, right? And it's not helpful. And so in some ways, I'm going to address it quickly, concisely, and I'm going to move on.
Thank you.
Yeah. Have you done – can you just tell us, like –
I have been a trainer for our organization for a while, but we are currently expanding to do trainings in the community, and coming up in the fall, we have a big law enforcement one, so this is very timely for us.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Okay, great. Yeah, so like Ms. said, if you'd want to chat any more about it when it gets closer, feel free to give us a call.
Great, thanks very much.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Next, we do have a question from Tucson, Arizona. Your line is open.
Hello. I am actually – oh, can you hear me?
Yep, I can hear you.
Okay, great. I am actually curious. One of the struggles that we come up against is actually getting in the door to provide training for law enforcement.
Mm-hmm.
Something that we come up against quite a bit is that, you know, there's certain requirements for officers each year that they have to go through certain trainings, you know, for their post-certification and whatnot, and I think they're a little bit resistant to the idea of advocates. We work at a prosecutor's office, but coming in to do a training when there's so much already on the plate for officers.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm just curious about strategies that you might have of being able to get in the door. I can appreciate the idea of partnering with someone from that agency.
Mm-hmm.
But if you have any ideas for other strategies or of either identifying those partners or identifying ways in which you can get into do and provide these types of trainings for law enforcement in ways that they'll be excited about it.
Yeah, I think like one of the, I'm glad you brought that up because I think a key strategy that we can use. So when I think that there's this idea that when we use the word training, we're sort of thinking like either a half day or an all day big event, either you pay or you don't pay and you get lunch and some donuts, right? Or in coffee during break. But there is this whole way in which we can train people and have it much more informal. So like I mentioned at our agency, we meet when the supervisors meet with their deputies. We just attend those every once in a while. We attend those meetings, right? So they get together on the third, you know, whatever, Wednesday every other month or something like that. And so we say, okay, can we be on your agenda? And can you give us at least, you know, this much time. And so we say, okay, we're going to have this much time here. And so they already get together already for that meeting. And so you want to already use their established meeting times and see if you can get on their agenda. And so I know it's not ideal in many ways, but if you can do that on a regular and ongoing basis, you don't have to try and address everything at one time, right? You can say, all right, this is the thing that's most happening and is on our radar. Let's address this. And so, you know, you're not going to, like, bring in a battered woman to speak, of course, that sort of a thing. But you can bring a story in that sort of thing. Or you could, you know, bring an audio tape or a short video. Or, you know, you could bring snippets of things. And so we have to find these informal ways through relationships and already established meetings to help do that. Does that
sure.
help?
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you.
Yeah.
And at this time, there are no additional guests in the queue.
All right. Melissa, do you have any kind of wrap-up comments before I just leave everyone with a couple of brief announcements?
Well, I think I pretty much said it all. I mean, I guess if I were just to quickly summarize, I would say don't do the training by yourself. Plan it ahead of time and really try and bring battered women's experiences into the room and know the policies of the organization.
And how often do you feel like is a good amount of time, and you know, the number of times per year that or annually that these trainings should be done, would you say? And what are the variables in determining that?
The variables for me are how much turnover there is in the agency. So with new hires, so if it depends on how big the department is or the region is, sometimes we just do a train just for new hires. And we do that, you know, when we know there's been quite a bit of turnover. Otherwise, we're doing sort of a big training every other year. And then we're doing smaller trainings or being a part of these meetings on a regular and ongoing basis.
And so what's a big training compared to, you know, a regular?
Well, big training is like an all-day, 8-hour event.
Okay.
Yeah, we're doing that usually every other year. And that's in part because we have so many people who've been there for so long and are really, you know, doing some really good work. But it's the thinking about the newly hired people that is, those are the people we're going to want to hit as soon as, you know, like annually and have a lot of contact with.
Yeah, right. Okay, well, that's very helpful, Melissa. You've given a wealth of information, I think, that people will be able to take away and digest over time in bits and pieces. So thank you very much for that. That's always so nice to have you as our trainer.
Thanks.
Thanks for making time for us. And to all of you, thanks for making time in your day for our call today. Just a couple of quick reminders. Excuse me. Praxis, the Rural Project, has a number of trainings coming up, both in-person, audio conference, video conference. So I just would encourage you all, don't hesitate to go to our website. You've probably been getting a number of emails from us with little bits and pieces about upcoming trainings, but it's all in one kind of concise area on our rural training page. So don't hesitate to go there to just find out what the latest and the greatest is, things that you want to be sure not to miss. excuse me. And also, I just want to remind you, please return your evaluation from today's session. It's always so helpful to us in planning future calls, so we always appreciate your feedback. And again, I think I mentioned briefly the opportunity that all of the rural grantees have for working with our Praxis technical assistance providers in customizing training that is individualized to you and your community based on what it is that you need and want. So keep that in mind, certainly, and contact me at any point if that's something that would be of use for your community. So with that, thanks, everybody, again, for joining us today. Melissa, thanks very much. And everybody, take care. I'll talk to you again.
Thanks.
Bye. Thank you.